It's Wisconsin Today. I'm Kate Archer-Kent.
And I'm Rob Ferret. Every spring, Wisconsinites have the opportunity to make their voices heard on issues related to our state's natural resources. The latest vote results came up late last week.
This year, 1,200 people attended in-person hearings hosted by the Wisconsin Conservation Congress. That's an elected body that advises the DNR on policy on behalf of citizens. Others voted online.
In all, almost 7,000 people weighed in on over 40 conservation-related questions.
The advisory votes shape the requests that the Congress brings to the DNR. A big theme this year is a willingness to increase fees for a variety of fishing and hunting licenses.
Patrick Durkin is president of the Wisconsin Outdoor Communicators Association. He writes for the Wisconsin Outdoor News, Meat Eater Media, and American Hunter magazine. He's been following these hearings for decades. Pat, thanks a lot for joining us.
Well, thanks for having me, Rob.
Now, there are a lot of questions related to fee increases that are related to conservation. Before we dig into the results, why are these fees such a big issue right now?
Well, this has been an issue going back 20 years since the last time Wisconsin raised the fees. And, you know, the increases used to be fairly common every few years. Now it's gone, you know, two decades without a fee increase. And previous attempts have brought up basically the same issues that we're seeing steady declines in our funding for the our natural resources. And this time it's on the spring hearings once again. But this requires, you know, acts of legislate mm-hmm. from the legislature. And so far they have not wanted to boost the fees.
What are the particular kind of fees that voters were asked about here, and what was their response?
Yeah, you know, two that were real direct ones were fee increases suggested for the annual trout stamp and also the annual turkey stamp. And those are both approved by pretty good margins. And also, you know, the big one for funding the DNR has always been our deer licenses. And that one, it wasn't singled out specifically, but that's one that really drives so much the DNR funding.
A couple of weeks ago, we heard from president of the Western Lake Superior Trolling Association, Jim Van Landschoot, about wildlife management cuts stemming from what the DNR says is insufficient spending authority granted by the legislature. Here's some of what Jim had to say about support for higher license fees to avoid cuts.
Everybody I've talked to in our group, you know, it's why haven't we had an increase since 2005? You know, inflation goes up every year. The costs of the DNR go up every year. But our license fees aren't keeping up with that. And we did try to push for an increase in our trout stamp a few years ago, and that failed. So I guess we're right back at the starting point there again, where we need a license fee increase to make the department solvent.
So, Pat, I think this seems significant. A lot of times if you ask people, hey, do you want to pay more for a thing that you pay money for? They'll say no. There seems to be a fair amount of yes out there. What is it that has a lot of conservation people, hunters, fishers saying, you know, maybe, yeah, we should pay some more money here?
Well, it is to me always interesting how the first thing hunters and anglers typically complain about are the fees for that we pay for these annual licenses. But when push comes to shove, though, when they see programs starting to get cut and they see access, you know, not being kept up, all those kind of things, they notice that. And so, like, what always happens, Rob, is the first year of a fee increase, you hear a lot of complaining. And then eventually the complaining kind of dies off. They get used to the idea that the fees are at a certain price now. And they start doing their own in-the-head calculations and realizing of all the things you can take into the field or take on into the boat or on the streams, that the license fee is always the cheapest. Yeah. And I spent Saturday, for instance, just walking through the Cabela's store over near Minneapolis. And I think of all the paraphernalia I keep for hunting and fishing. And I think, yeah, in the big picture, a license fee is pretty small potatoes.
Now, some key fishing seasons just kicked off over the weekend, and the DNR had just announced, hey, we're going to close some hatcheries, we're stocking less in some places. Are people on the ground or in the water, I guess, actually seeing the impact of not having these fee increases in action with, you know, maybe ultimately fewer fish where they go fishing?
Well, you know, the hatchery issue, depending on what you're fishing for, it might not affect what you do. And so it's going to affect everyone differently on that one. And plus, with fishing, and especially fishing, it can be so unpredictable how you'll do on any given day when you go fishing. It can, there's so many factors, whether it's weather, wind, all these kind of things. So it's always hard to pinpoint exactly why you aren't catching fish. But, you know, I just look at this and wish we don't, wish we'd quit having the same discussions year after year. We know what the problem is, and lawmakers, it basically comes down to the legislature. They have not wanted to increase the fees because they always seem to think that any kind of fee increase is seen as a tax increase. And I don't think the average hunter and fisherman just goes that far with that. They accept these things. It's always been a pay-as-you-go system, and we kind of accept that.
Talking to outdoor writer Patrick Durkin about the results of the Wisconsin Conservation Congress's spring hearing, where they get the public's opinion on potential natural resource policies. A lot of support for various kinds of fee increases in this year's vote. Patrick, talk a little bit about that process. What happens next? We've got these votes in hand. These are advisory, of course. As you've mentioned, they don't change policy. What do people do with these results? How do they go up the ladder next?
Well, in about 3 weeks from now, we'll have the annual Wisconsin Conservation Congress's annual convention, and they'll look at these questions again, and probably push forth to have them on next year's ballot again, and make them an actual proposal, a little more official clout to it. But ultimately, it's always going to come down to people having to contact their lawmakers, let them know that they support these things. And if they don't hear much from their constituents on this, they just kind of take it as something that's not that important to them. And so I just always point out to my readers that these things, these programs don't happen by accident. They require staff, they require equipment, and all these things that cost money. And you won't get them without funding, for them. So it's an issue that's been there a long time now, and I think I hope people start realizing this is getting serious now. We're 20 years, and we're getting behind.
Now, this year's vote saw a fairly low response rate, the lowest since 2019, I think. Does that mean that people are paying attention, participating less, or is it that there wasn't like a big hot button issue, like, hey, we're gonna ask about deer hunting regulations and earn a buck or something like that?
Right. Yeah, this was the lowest one we've seen in participation since about 2019, and it typically takes one or two real controversial issues. 20 years ago, 25 years ago, one that came up was discussions of the mourning dove season, and that one popped up a lot, and people got out there for that. And we also had one you might remember in 2005 where. Someone proposed that the hunters be allowed to shoot feral cats when they're out in the field. And that one jumped up, got people all agitated about that. And so those things happen. And I guess when you look back on, every year I track the attendance of this, and I keep a chart going back to, I think 1972. And you always see these fluctuations. And the thing I'll always point out to the people is that, this year's attendance was low. But if you ever go to the Capitol to attend hearings, most bills that get hearings don't draw those kind of numbers overall. So to me, this is still an accessible way that people have to communicate their thoughts and their wishes to the people who represent them.
Yeah, mourning doves and feral cats were definitely hot issues here on Wisconsin Public Radio as well. I remember them well. Now, for these in-person meetings, right, people could vote online now, which they couldn't back then. What is it like, though, when you go to the in-person hearing? Set the scene for us.
Yeah, it's to me, it's always a tough thing. The old expression about the democratic process being something you might not want to witness in person, it can be like that. Some nights you have these hearings, and the discussion just gets pretty hard to sit through sometimes. But I think that's kind of the way I think it should work, that we sometimes have to be made a little uncomfortable by the process. But it's cool for me to see DNR people stand up and talk about questions, answer questions from people. And sometimes the group, when it involves anything besides deer, they often will listen to that perspective from a professional and vote that way. But then deer come up, and you'll always have these folks who they deer hunt. They've been deer hunting all their life. They know more than the DNR does about it, so they just reject whatever the DNR person was saying. And so it can be fun. It can be tedious. And I guess, though, I keep going to the ones in person because I still think that's where you get a better feel for what's really on people's minds.
Yeah, obviously a lot more than, say, 7,000 Wisconsinites hike or hunt or fish or canoe or all of the above or some of the above. What would you say to people to get them to suggest that they get involved, whether they go to the hearing or want to vote online or just keep closer track of issues that affect their outdoor experience?
Yeah, the one thing I really like about the online option that we have now, you have basically 3 days to go online and take the survey, go through the questions and weigh in. So you don't have to sit through the in-person discussion. And the questions that are on the questionnaire each spring, they often have a good explanation about what the debate's all about. And so to me, I just think if you just did that much every spring, you'd keep in touch a lot better with the issues that are percolating out there in the Wisconsin landscape.
Patrick, we'll leave it there. Thanks again for joining us.
You bet. Always enjoy it.
That's Patrick Durkin, outdoors writer and reporter based in Wisconsin. He talked with us about the results of the Wisconsin Conservation Congress spring hearing, which gives a snapshot of public opinion on natural resource management in the state. Have you gone to one of these in person? Have you gone to lots of these in person? Or did you vote online this year or last year? Love to hear about your experiences and why you participate. Let us know. Email wisconsintoday@wpr.org. That email again, wisconsintoday@wpr.org.
Manufacturing jobs are on the decline in Wisconsin. The latest data from the Labor Department shows 8,600 fewer jobs in 2025 than the previous year.
The decrease was larger in durable goods, things like appliances and tools. The decline was less for non-durable goods, things like paper towels and food.
But the industry as a whole continues to see challenges with an aging workforce and a shortage of labor.
Layoffs were down in 2025 compared to 2024, but Wisconsin has already seen multiple factories announce closures since the start of this year.
Polaris is laying off close to 200 workers in Osceola, and Wells Vehicle Electronics in Fond du Lac is laying off 100 workers next month.
We're taking a closer look now at what's driving these labor challenges in the manufacturing sector and what the rest of 2026 could bring for the industry.
Steve Deller is Professor Emeritus in the Department of Agricultural and Applied Economics at UW-Madison and a recently retired Division of Extension Community Economic Development Specialist. Steve, welcome back to the show.
Thank you for having me.
You know, manufacturing declines aren't new, but are you seeing some workforce challenges accelerate these declines in recent years?
I think that there's a couple of things that are happening. One is that Wisconsin, along with a lot of the other Midwestern states that are heavily dependent on manufacturing, has been facing a structural labor shortage for a number of years now. And what we're seeing is manufacturing adopting new technologies, particularly with the advent of AI. There's a lot of experimentation with that, and they're trying to find alternatives to hiring people and still maintain their output. So there's a kind of a shift that way, but there's also kind of a natural ebb and flow to the economy, and manufacturing and other industries like construction tend to be sensitive to that. And right now, there's a lot of indications that the economy is going into a slowdown phase, and manufacturing is kind of signaling that.
Well, on the point of technological improvements and AI, is productivity improving on the assembly line? I mean, that would be a good thing overall.
Yes, productivity has been increasing. And historically, wages and labor productivity are kind of tied at the hip.
Mm-hmm.
Unfortunately, that relationship has broken down. So when we see increases in labor productivity, we're not seeing that corresponding increase in wages. And that has a lot of economists kind of scratching their heads trying to understand why that relationship is broken down.
We've talked about the baby boomers who are fully retiring now. Why aren't manufacturers able to replace their aging and retiring workforce?
Part of it is a generational change. Is manufacturing still has this kind of reputation of being hard and perhaps dirty work. And there are some of the younger generations are really not interested in going into manufacturing. They're seeing other employment opportunities. So manufacturing doesn't have that draw that it used to have 30, 40, 50 years ago.
When you see these manufacturing jobs declining like this, what effect does that have on the state's economy? What ripple effect will we see?
Wisconsin is still heavily manufacturing dependent, and there's a range. One of the things about Wisconsin manufacturing is that it's very what we call heterogeneous. We're not dominated by one particular type of manufacturing, like, say, food processing or paper. So we have a very diverse manufacturing.
And that's good to be diversified.
It is extremely important to be diversified. There is a tremendous amount of research out there that has demonstrated again and again that the more diversified your economy, the more resilient your economy is to shocks and to kind of growth opportunities. Having said that, though, Wisconsin is still pretty heavily dependent on manufacturing. And again, manufacturing tends to be more sensitive to downward trends in the economy or that kind of ebb and flow. You see that in manufacturing first. Indeed, some of the leading economic indicators out there that do a really good job of forecasting what's going to happen in the economy zeroes in on what's happening to manufacturing. For the Midwest, the upper Midwest, some of those indicators they're kind of looking down. So these employment numbers are not completely surprising.
Okay, so enter tariffs. Do you think tariffs have played a role here if manufacturers are paying more to import parts and goods? Do they look to pay less in labor to offset those added costs?
Yes, the tariffs are still rippling their way through. The research is not completely in agreement, but it can take 9 months to 18 months for the effects of the tariffs to kind of ripple through the economy. And even though the tariffs have been lifted, well, many of them have been lifted, there's still tariffs in place. The effects of those tariffs are still rippling through the economy. And this is partially what we're seeing now is kind of disruptions of manufacturing because of those tariff policies.
What about offshoring the assembly process? So maybe your corporate headquarters are still here in Wisconsin, but you're making these parts, you're making these products in another place in the world. Could that have an impact on the decline that we're seeing?
Long term, yes. I think if we were having this conversation 20 years ago, I would be saying, yes, that is definitely what's happening. We're seeing less of that occurring now because a lot of the offshoring that could occur has already occurred. A lot of the manufacturing that's within the U.S. is kind of higher end product type manufacturing. What the U.S. still has a good comparative advantage in is kind of custom manufacturing and higher end product manufacturing. And we still have that. And that's where the growth is occurring. But that kind of commodity type manufacturing, the inexpensive socks that you buy at a Walmart or a Dollar General, that's going to be produced overseas. We can't really compete in that market.
We're talking about declining manufacturing jobs in Wisconsin. Steve Deller is here, Professor Emeritus in the Department of Agricultural and Applied Economics at UW-Madison. Steve, Are changes to the manufacturing workforce and these declines felt more strongly in Wisconsin's rural communities?
Not necessarily.
Okay.
Well, two parts to that answer. One is that when you look at where a lot of the manufacturing in Wisconsin is located, it's actually in the more urban centers. Indeed, the biggest food manufacturing county in Wisconsin is Milwaukee County. So it's not necessarily, I mean, so if you look at the numbers, a lot of the jobs are actually located in more urban areas. Having said that, when you do see declines in manufacturing employment in rural areas, it tends to be more visible. It tends to be kind of, it stands out more because the employment base is smaller. So when you see these, you know, a manufacturing firm that says lays off 100 employees in Milwaukee is kind of lost to background noise. That same occurring in a smaller rural community.
Like Fond du Lac. Yeah.
Yeah. You can see it. It's more visible.
The Wisconsin Center for Manufacturing and Productivity, it did a survey last fall. It found 65% manufacturers were confident in the direction of the economy. 90% were confident in their own financial outlook. And those numbers increased from previous year's surveys. How should we evaluate those types of numbers based on what we're seeing now with the 2025 declines?
I think that given the uncertainty and kind of the whipsaw of policy that's occurring over the past year and a half, I think that folks are trying to put on a positive face. I think that folks are trying to, they're kind of seeing around them this notion that the economy is at risk, and they're looking at their own business and they're saying, well, our business seems to be doing okay. So they're kind of trying to be optimistic. They're trying to take a glass half full approach. But that doesn't distract from the uncertainty that the economy is facing right now and the kind of the headwinds that the economy is starting to experience. And then more recently, the shock with oil supply and the cost of energy, it's just kind of, the headwinds are getting stronger and stronger, and it's going to be harder to push against those headwinds.
Energy is sending its own shockwaves as well.
Exactly. There is some research out there that if you look at the U.S. economy overall, and you look at kind of periods that we've gone into economic downturns, a lot of times that's predicated by shocks to the energy market. And this goes back to post-World War II. So whenever we see a real shock to the energy market, that's a real warning flag that something's going to happen to the economy in the next 12 to 18 months.
Okay, in our final moments together, grab that crystal ball because, you know, we've seen a few Wisconsin factories announcing layoffs and closures to start this year. Are you expecting the state's decline in manufacturing jobs to continue in upcoming jobs reports?
I think over the next 12 months, next year, I think we're going to see stability and a downward trend. I don't think we're going to be seeing falling off of a cliff. I don't think we're going to see anything like the Great Recession. That's not in the cards, but I do think that we're going to be going into a slowdown period where a lot of businesses are just going to start tightening the belt more and more. So a slowdown, yes. A recession, if we go into a recession, it will probably be a mild recession. But again, what's happening with the energy markets, that's the wild card right now. And if this continues to drag out, that recession may be a little bit more severe.
Steve, appreciate you. Thank you so much for joining us in this context.
Love talking with you. Thank you.
Steve Deller is Professor Emeritus in the Department of Agricultural and Applied Economics at UW-Madison. He was with us to discuss Wisconsin's loss of over 8,000 manufacturing jobs last year and what it means for the state's workforce and the economy. It's Wisconsin Today. I'm Kate Archer-Kinn.
And I'm Rob Ferret. If you had to guess where the oldest Chinese restaurant in the U.S. was located, would you guess Janesville?
The Cozy Inn has been a staple on West Milwaukee Street in Janesville for over a century. And after a restaurant in Montana closed last month, the Cozy Inn became the oldest continuously operating Chinese restaurant in the entire country.
Since 1922, the Cozy Inn has been serving classic dishes like chop suey and chow mein. Cozy Inn owner Tom Fong joins us now. Tom, welcome back to the show.
Thank you. Pleasure.
All right. You are part of restaurant history here. The Cozy Inn opened its doors in 1922. How does it feel now to have the title of the oldest continually operating Chinese restaurant in the country?
It's a little surreal. I never really thought about the longevity of the restaurant. But before I say anything, I want to tip my hat off to Peking, who's, you know, managed to keep that business for 115 years. So I congratulate them. But I never really thought about our longevity.
And your time at the Cozy Inn first started as a kid working alongside your parents. What are some of your earliest memories of the restaurant?
We went through a lot of struggles, a lot of obstacles and challenges, because my mom didn't speak English very well with my stepdad. So it was just basically my brother and I and the business at the time when my mother bought the business. It wasn't very busy at all. I think the previous owners, they just sort of maybe mentally got just tired of the business, and they just sort of let it slide. And we had to try to resurrect the business again. And as a 14 and a 16-year-old, it was a challenge.
What do you think were some of the changes you made at that time, you and your brother and your mom made at that time, that helped revive it and helped it survive? Because restaurants don't always survive.
Correct. You're really right on the money about that. When we first came to Janesville, my mom was sort of a trailblazer in Milwaukee because she was a head chef in many Chinese restaurants, popular Chinese restaurants in Milwaukee. And that was sort of unheard of as a woman becoming a head chef. And so when she came to Janesville, we brought these different Cantonese dishes because there wasn't much selection in Janesville at all. There was only two other Chinese restaurants, and they were pretty much just chop suey and chow mein. There wasn't much other things. So my mom brought a lot of different dishes, and she introduced it to this community of Janesville back in 1974, 75.
Well, I want to get hungry now. Can you name some of those Cantonese dishes she brought over?
Right. So we try to keep the food quality, you know, the same as what my mother did, because she was such a passion for cooking. Sort of things like the Cantonese chow mein. In fact, I don't think there's not too many that have them here locally. I think we're the only one that has that dish. And things like sweet and sour pork, the way we prepare our pork is totally different from the other restaurants. We do it the old style, the Hong Kong style. And a lot of the new ones, they just do it totally different.
What's the Hong Kong style?
It's sort of like a dry flour type deep fried, and where the other ones use like a wet flour, like a wet breading, sort of like you find like on fish fries, you know, that you fry fish with, that kind of a batter. Ours is sort of a drier type, totally done differently. So also our egg rolls are different.
How are your egg rolls different?
We home make ours. A lot of them, they pre-buy them from factories, and we do it the old school with our ingredients. So it's a long process. So it's a little different, and people love our egg rolls. They're just different from the other people's egg rolls.
Now, you stepped away from the restaurant for a time. I understand you opened up your own place. What ended up bringing you back?
Well, I got married, and then I had a child, and my mother was running the business with my brother. And then my mom wanted to see the grandchild more often, so she persuaded me to sell that business and come back because she wanted to retire anyways. She was getting up in age a little bit, so she wanted to retire. So then that's when my wife and I and my brother sort of took over for a while.
We're talking about Janesville's Cozy Inn, now the longest-running Chinese restaurant in America. After first opening in 1922, owner Tom Fong is with us. Tom, you mentioned your wife, and I understand she has some of the responsibility for the success, or you share some of that with her.
Let's put it this way. She's the one that really brought the success into the business, because she's such a people person, and the way she interacts with the customers, she has a very, I would say, intimate bond with these customers now. And they're our community support is actually sort of like a heartbeat of the Cozy Inn, you know, because we face many challenges, things like COVID and when they tore the streets out and there was hard access to our business, and the community rallied around us and they put it on Facebook and other social media. And the next thing we knew, we had this great support of people constantly coming in, supporting us, you know. And my wife, the way she doesn't look customers as patrons. She looks at them sort of like friends. So the way she communicates with them, there's just a special bond. She starts to know them personally, and she knows their family, and she gets to understand, you know, just the people of who they are. It's sort of strange. She knows like how many children they have. They know that she knows their grandchildren. She knows their orders. It's so strange. So yeah, that's my wife. So I believe she's really the heart of the success.
And Tom, you know, public radio, we've been around over 100 years here, and we hear people, you know, started listening with their parents or their grandparents. Is it like that at the Cozy Inn, where you've got, you know, people, maybe they started eating there at age 2 and now they're bringing their kids or their grandkids in?
Yes, I've seen like 5 generations. And after all these, you know, I just speak to a lot of them, and being in the restaurant, it becomes nostalgic to them. They make memories in those booths. They sit and they talk and they laugh. And sometimes it's strange how my wife, well, here's an example of how she can get the mood settings up to get their dining experience, like a positive dining experience. There's used to be this couple that used to come in and they would just sit down and they both pick up their phones. And during the meal, they would not talk to each other. They would just stare at their phones. And between the appetizer and the main course, my wife starts talking to them, speaking to them, and having a small conversation. The next thing you know, they drop their phones, and then they're talking with each other with my wife, and they're laughing. And then next thing you know, my wife walks away, and the couple's still talking, and they're having, you know, the experience and a nice dining experience. That's one of the things my wife can do. It's sort of strange, but she does.
That's amazing. One of the things you're known for, as I read about your restaurant, is a big menu with a lot of options in it. Tell us a little bit about the variety you've got on your menu there.
Yeah, so you have to change, because we notice, as you know, from the earlier days, we see the different types of diet, how their tastes. It starts to change. So we know the younger people, they like more spicier and more sweet dishes. And the older generations, they're more into like the plain, just a regular chop suey chow mein dishes. So we always have to adapt, you know, to the changes of the people now, to the public.
I got to ask, Tom, when you're off the clock, but you're at the restaurant and you want something to eat, what are your go-to favorite foods when Tom is the customer instead of the owner?
At the restaurant?
Yeah.
I think it's my favorite. It's like I said, it's a Cantonese dish. Hmm. Usually I have like a roast pork Cantonese. And also, I love curry, so I make a lot of curry dishes.
And now, what are your hopes for the future of Cozy Inn?
We're trying to... We feel loyal to this community, so we don't really want to shut down. And by the time I've been there like 52 years personally, you know, on and off, but mainly I've been there since 1974. And my wife's been there 38, but we're hopefully we can find like a relative or something and take over once we get too old, when my wife, you know, starts to wants to retire because of, you know, age, but she wants to feel loyal. We're going to try to, you know, have relatives and train them really well to keep the business going.
Well, good luck with those future plans, Tom, and thanks for joining us again.
Thank you. Thank you very much.
Tom Fong owns the Cozy Inn Chinese restaurant in Janesville. We've been talking about the Cozy Inn recently becoming the longest running, continuously operating Chinese restaurant in the United States. Wisconsin Today producers include Beatrice Lawrence, Lauren Cox, and Royce Podeswa.
Our technical directors are Sarah Hopeful and Tyler Ditter.
Learn more about us at wpr.org/Wisconsin Today. I'm Rob Ferret.
And I'm Kate Archer-Kent. You're listening to WPR News.